Okay, so this morning I'm going to be talking about trauma, PTSD, and incarceration history in a nationally representative sample of Black Americans. And I have no conflicts of interest to disclose, nor have any of my co-authors, which I would really like to acknowledge briefly because they've done a fantastic job helping me putting this together. So, before we get started, I would like to just spend a minute on terminology, and because I will be switching back and forth between different terms that are stemming from different disciplines. So traditionally in criminology, people are talking about offenders or perpetrators of crime when they talk about people that are in contact with the criminal justice system. While in psychology, we really talk more about externalizing behaviors like aggression or substance use that can get you in trouble. Correspondingly, criminology more talks about victims, and I'm also going to be talking about trauma-exposed individuals, or if that trauma has negative consequences, traumatized people. So as you might be aware, the amount of incarceration happening in the United States amounts to a public health crisis affecting over 2 million people that are currently incarcerated across prison and jail settings. And, of course, not everybody shares the same likelihood of going to prison. And this is a graph showing the likelihood of lifetime imprisonment across gender and ethnicity. And as you can see, the highest likelihood of imprisonment is up there for Black men, with 1 in 3 going to prison once in their life. That excludes the additional probability of being arrested and going to jail. And just as a short reminder, the difference between prison and jail is usually that jails are locally operated short-term facilities, and they include in their population people in pretrial detention, so that have not yet been found guilty, while prisons are your federal and state-run penitentiaries for long-term sentences. On the other hand, we also have a high prevalence of trauma and PTSD in the general population, and especially individuals from urban low-income communities live in areas where the prevalence rates of PTSD ranges from 17 to 24%. This is really high. This is rates that you would expect to see in war zones. And it is exactly those same individuals that also have the highest likelihood of contact with the criminal justice system. So there have been a lot of explanations to explain this overlap between victims and perpetrators of crime. And there's a lot of literature from both the criminology and the psychology side that talk about this phenomenon. One of the explanations is that on the community level, it's simply that, let me just move that, there's victims and perpetrators live in the same neighborhood. So they share an environment, and thus they also share their demographic profile. On top of that, if you think of selective targeting of high crime neighborhoods by police, there is also an increased likelihood of detection of maybe minor transgressions that might go unnoticed in other areas, further kind of making this overlap stronger. But there's other explanations that focus on the individual level too. And there is a lot of research that shows that if you are a perpetrator of aggressive crime, you are more likely to also become victim of aggressive crimes, mainly retaliatory crimes, which kind of makes sense if you think about it. The whole literature about the code of the street mentality has shown that this mentality that kind of mandates swift retaliation after you've been victimized to reestablish respect and kind of keep you safe in the future actually does the opposite. It makes you have a higher likelihood of becoming a victim of homicide and violence if you endorse that mentality. But there's a third explanation, and that's the one that I'm going to really be focusing on today, and that is the development of psychopathology following exposure to trauma. So after you've been exposed to a traumatic event, you can develop post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD. And symptoms of PTSD include irritability, hyperarousal, outbursts of anger, and loss of fear, all of which could put you at an increased risk of being exposed to the criminal justice system because you might be more on edge and react more aggressively in normal encounters, making it more likely that you might be caught up in an escalation, either in a situation, say, at a bar or in exchanges with law enforcement. There is another pathway through which symptoms of PTSD or trauma exposure can set you up for increased likelihood of contact with the criminal justice system, and that is lingering effects of trauma, like re-experiencing or nightmares, might prompt you to cope with illicit substances, and then, of course, you're more likely to get arrested for drug offenses. There is mainly one source of evidence for this hypothesis, and it comes from inmate samples. Across a lot of different studies, repeatedly in juveniles and in adults, there has been shown that there's an increased prevalence of both trauma and PTSD in those samples. However, we don't have population studies looking at this connection. And this is a problem, because inmate samples are heavily biased. So, if you think about it, this is kind of my flowchart of a typical criminal justice process. In order to end up being an inmate, either in a jail or in a prison, you're at the end of a long administrative process. There's many steps involved in that process, and at each step, there's a chance that some systematic bias gets introduced into this decision making, and that part of the sample is selectively dropped. So kind of think of it as a funnel, where the sample of who actually gets investigated, arrested, and then, you know, kept in custody, going through trial, and is then convicted, gets successively smaller. From a research methodological perspective, that's serious non-random attrition. So, this means that it is important to examine these mechanisms of how trauma and PTSD are related to involvement with the criminal justice system in a population that is most affected by both. So a nationally representative sample of Black Americans, which is what we did in this study. We also wanted to examine differences in type and frequency of trauma exposure and how that fits in with system contact. So I'm kind of going to rush through this in the interest of time, but I'm happy to answer questions about the sample and any other things you might be interested in at the end. So we used the National Survey of American Life, which is a nationally representative sample of African American and Blacks from Caribbean descent living in the U.S. And I just want to point out that in our sample of 5,189 respondents, exposure to the criminal justice system was prevalent. We have over half of the men reporting that they've been arrested, and almost 20% of women. And 23% of men reported that they've been incarcerated, and 8.5% of the women. That is a population sample. That's a lot of people. So our exposures, we measured trauma, frequency, and used an ranging from 1 to more than 4, or 0 from more than 4 events. And we used exploratory factor analysis to identify 3 subtypes. And again, I'm happy to talk more about that at the end. The first subtype is kind of like your general trauma, everything ranging from being assaulted to witnessing a natural disaster. The second one, perpetration related, was really just 2 items. Either accidentally or intentionally hurting someone badly. And then war-related trauma is pretty much either participating in combat or living through a war zone as a refugee. PTSD, DSM-4 diagnosis, yes or no. And our outcomes were arrest, juvenile detention, jail, imprisonment, and any incarceration. Now, the results look similar for all those outcomes, but I'm going to concentrate on talking about arrest and any incarceration, but I have the full results at the end if you would like to see them. So we did logistic regressions adjusted for the usual suspects: age, gender, ethnicity, income, education, comorbid mood and substance use disorders. And in fact, all models that we looked at were the same for men and women, so we used combined models. We did not separate by gender. And corrected for complex sampling design. Now the results. This is the likelihood of arrest by exposure to trauma. And as you can see, even having one traumatic event increases your odds for reporting arrest. And as you increase the number of traumas, so increases your likelihood. It's a kind of a nice dose-response relationship, if you want. When we look at the type of trauma, you can see that all traumas, experiencing all traumas versus not experiencing that type of trauma, increases your odds for arrest. And, well, the highest odds with four-time increased likelihood is perpetration trauma, which was kind of expected due to the nature of that trauma. Just as a reminder, that was intentionally or accidentally hurting someone. So you would expect that there should be some connection to that. Similar results when we look at likelihood of incarceration. Again, even having, well, one traumatic event wasn't significantly increasing the odds, but then going up 2 to 3 and more than 4 does increase it. And when you look at the type of trauma, see that, again, experiencing every type increases your odds. Interestingly, perpetration trauma doesn't really come out differently from general trauma. Just as a kind of, yeah, that always just makes me think about what these people are incarcerated for.
Is it a combination of men and women?
Yes. Yeah. But the relationship was the same for both. Then we have PTSD. And again, the same picture. Having PTSD on top of, so this is reduced sample to just people who have experienced at least one traumatic event. And having PTSD on top, or endorsing lifetime PTSD on top of that, again, increases your odds for both arrest and incarceration. Okay, so what does that mean? Well, we see there is this dose-response relationship between frequency of trauma and contact with the criminal justice system, which is similar across multiple measures of confinement. And as I said, we looked at other outcomes, juvenile incarceration, jail, etc., and it was the same pretty much across all those outcomes. So, and that holds true for men and women. Then secondly, quality of trauma does not really seem to be distinct of trauma exposure, because the relationship is significant for all types of trauma. So it really seems to be more this frequency of trauma that is important. And PTSD above and beyond trauma experience itself is associated with elevated odds for involvement with the criminal justice system. But the strength of the relationship is less than for the highest frequency of trauma exposure. Again, kind of pointing to the importance of this repeated exposure to different types of trauma. So what do we do with that? When we talk first, before going into talking about strengths and limitations, I really want to spend a moment talking about what it actually was that we measured here. What is criminal behavior, and who are offenders, and what is system contact anyways? A lot of you might remember this picture taken in this city, or these pictures, sorry, taken in this city after the devastating Hurricane Katrina. Now, why am I showing this to you? What do we see here? Well, we see three people waiting in water, carrying what seems like groceries. And that's where it stops, really. Yet, on the left-hand side, it says that this person is looting, while on the right-hand side, those two people are finding food. The point I want to make with this is that I think it's really important to remember that criminal behavior is the perception of a behavior as criminal. It is not the same thing as an objective behavior itself. And this is really important to remember because, as I said earlier, the pathway to becoming an offender and the problem with selective attrition throughout this process leads you to very biased samples. And no matter how much we try, there are these different steps in the process where you have to make assumptions about intentions of people. And I just think that a lot of times when we look at crime statistics and when we look at offender samples, we tend to forget that this is not an accurate mirror of what is going on in the bigger population. So when we're dealing with population samples, we also have the flip side of that bias, which is we are not looking at people who are still incarcerated. Arguably, probably the deep end of that population, so the people that received really long sentences are going to be missing. So within our framework of victimization, reaction to trauma, and externalizing behaviors and how that kind of leads to system contact, we can't tell with this study what exactly is happening. But it could be that incarceration is the trauma. Or at least it is the context that promotes a hypervigilance and fear that leads to symptoms and self-treatment after release, pointing to a possible cycle of system contact and then re-victimization over and over. A process that is likely exacerbated in a population of minority men because they are disproportionately subject to incarceration instead of referrals to substance abuse treatment after drug offenses. It could also be that it is subtle changes in interactions with other people that increases the probability for subsequent arrest. Through more escalation in interactions with law enforcement. On top of that, it is possible that previously arrested and incarcerated individuals are more likely to be identified in subsequent investigations. Just think of mugshots and what they're. It's kind of inherent in police work that it is easier to identify people who are already known. So, no matter how you look at it, there is a robust relationship between this chronic accumulated trauma exposure and incarceration history in this representative sample. More importantly, I think, this relationship holds for arrest, which is arguably the step in the process where there is the most discretion of the involved actors. I think that the findings of this study can inform programs and policies that are aimed at interrupting the processes that put traumatized people at an increased risk for system contact, even though we need to know more about how this exactly happens. And that's that. Thank you very much.
I actually think we're doing so well, we have time for one question, if somebody has one question.
And this is
So the
teaching
issues associated with incarceration is striking. I'm wondering how you control for racial profiling and take the discrimination forward.
Well,
that kind of entered into your thinking. You kind of touched it at the end. And those of us that are maybe more advanced in the field were like thinking, when is she going to talk about it? So it's such an obvious explanation for why people are in jail. And so I'm wondering how you kind of thought about it as you were doing your being studying together. You did feel a bit of advantage about it.
Yeah. Well, for one thing, I mean, this is a sample that is reduced to just Black Americans, so we don't have the comparison within that study. But when I think about it, I really think about, when I was talking about this this funnel and what goes on and all and those decision points that are being made. And it really starts in the beginning when, you know, in order to start an investigation, someone needs to call the police or the police sees something happening. So that's this first step. When you see someone doing something and you think this wasn't right, this is a criminal behavior. So that's where it starts. And so and from then on, you go throughout the process. And so I really, for this study and for this talk, I wanted to frame it as a measurement issue too, because if we when we take those statistics and use them, what are we really measuring here? What are we really using? It's what comes out at the end of a very long process.
I would recommend that you build on that and build it in earlier, because it is part of what impacts incarceration.
Thank you.
When I see anything.